da hazırlıyız. Na, seit Andach, also blieb. Das weiter gibt vor Fanele. We'd like to start now, but we're just putting a few logistics. I think that in the next 5 minutes we should be able to start. I should really apologize that we meant to start at 5:30. But there are some logistics that we will be talking about. We'll be starting in the next few minutes. 5 minutes time, we should be starting. Please bear with us. We'll be very much behind time and can lose the people that are here. So, with the... I think that we would rather start. We should welcome our colleagues from National Treasury who are going to address us on the preferential procurement regulation. Colleagues will remember that we had this meeting in August. There were certain things, issues that we raised with them. We requested them to address the issue that we raised with them. Now, today, they are coming here to give us a feedback. There are documents that have been distributed to every member here and everyone else. So, I would like to request the two gentlemen that are here. Among the things that they are not addressing is the gender issue, I think. Okay, no, it's fine. I see a real issue of the gender. Not very comfortable. I don't know, but the gentlemen who are addressing us are Mr. Malina and Mr. Matebula. I'm not sure who is leading the delegation. We are in your hands, Mr. Malina.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for inviting us again this morning. And we welcome the opportunity to come and address the House. When we last met, we had the draft regulations that had just been published. We met just before we had requested that we close for comments, which was supposed to have been on the 14th of September. It was the request of this House that maybe we should relook at the closing time, given the interest.
Sorry, Mr. Madden. I don't know if you're not speaking very softly. I'm not if people can hear but I suspect that if you can just pull it, the mic a little bit down.
Okay, thank you. It was the request of this House that we move the date, and we duly did move the date to the 30th of September. Now, throughout that process, we received 148 comments on the draft regulations. From that period until now, what we did was to classify each one of the comments into the various groups. What private sector says, what organized labor says, what public sector says, and what state-owned entities say, and our comments to that. We are here today to indicate to you what the feeling of the people is out there. We did take into consideration the comments that were given to us by the House. You may notice that the regulations have not been changed since we received the comments from the House. We would want to combine all the comments and then give a final draft of this. The process that we'd want to follow is we need to have another draft that incorporates all these comments. And based on on that draft that we need to have another round of discussions around that draft prior to promulgation. Our target date remains the beginning of the financial year, which is April 1, that they should come into effect. And we also are still on course to have our lead time where we will be training the practitioners that are going to utilize these regulations. In front of you, you'll have a summary of comments between myself and my colleague here, Mr. Matebula, who will try and address each one of these comments. Now, on the regulations, as you know, there are 18 elements of the regulations that are being addressed. Now, we've captured each one of the elements that is addressed, what the comments are, and what is our view towards the comments. Just if I may start.
The document that is being distributed now is trying to as well to remind you with some of the issues that I think that your document must address. The document that is being distributed now are the minutes of that meeting, our own minutes of that meeting, which I think that therefore your document perhaps will also have to look at that. But the document has been distributed. We will not go through it. All we need to do is that you will continue, in fact. As you continue, you just ensure that there's a balance. Those issues are being addressed. And members will raise them if they feel that they are not being addressed. Honorable Mashiko.
Asking for this document.
Okay, I continue, Bamal. So we have to reserve some a copy or copies for them. I don't want to ambush them. I'm correct that is not minutes, but the analysis of our researchers that was actually meant for us. Now we're making you privy to our own documentation, how good we are. Okay, we can continue.
Thanks, I do realize I have a career after this now. Chairperson and the House, the issues that were raised here, as I mentioned up front, that these are the issues that we got from the various angles, being private sector, organized labor, public sector, and the state-owned entities. We also did say at the time when we left this House that we were going to make available to this House these comments, and what is it that we think we can be addressed and not be addressed. If I may just start on the regulation, the first portion of regulation talks to definitions. All three the sectors that are commented, they raised issues of ambiguity that we find in defining some of the things here. And of course, ambiguity is how you understand the definition of a particular word. Within our response to it, yes, we agree that there may be ambiguities in the definition of definitions of some of the words here. However, that can be addressed when we do the final legal refinement of the document, because it needs to go through the final legal refinement that will deal with issues of definitions. But what struck us most was some of the definitions that the people were looking at us having to relook are definitions of what BEE means, triple BEE means, and they wanted us to extend the definition to indicate exactly what that it doesn't. It's for blacks, disadvantaged women, and white women, and disabled. So, to us, the definitions of triple BEE are captured in the Act, and if it's captured in the Act, we cannot tamper with those definitions that are captured in the Act. And it's also not an Act that is within the jurisdiction of the National Treasury. So those, we cannot address them in the regulations. The other things that they were looking at, of course, very little things like, what do we mean by offer? You know, we need to explain exactly what is an offer and what is a bid and what is a bidder. And I can imagine we would be in a position of refining those things. Now, the next one was, where would this regulation apply? To whom must it apply? You'd remember the last time I said it will apply to even the state-owned enterprises, but at that time there was a little bit of sort of a little storm that came out by SOSAI. Funny enough, in the formal comments, no state-owned enterprise said they don't want them. They all said, yes, it's fine. Let them apply to them. But we also are also mindful of the fact that most of the state-owned enterprises are also controlled by their various boards. Now, the mandate of the boards, we do not want to tamper with that. We'd like to make these regulations available or make them applicable to these state-owned enterprises without having to take away the mandate of the various parts of these state-owned enterprises. Then the other area which people commented on was the area of, in the previous one, there was also organized labor saying that we also need to make it available to organizations where the state owns 50% of shareholding. That's a bit of a challenge because we don't know who would be controlling, who's got the controlling share. Rather, let's talk to those where we have got a controlling share on. The third one was around the regulation that talks to planning and stipulation of preference point systems to be utilized. Now, we say upfront, in your special conditions of contract, you need to stipulate the criteria or the preference points that are going to be utilized. If you are going to use 90-10, you need to indicate exactly we are on a 90-10 point system or on an 80-20 point system. That needs to be stipulated upfront in the conditions of contract as one of the evaluation criteria. So the comments that we received were that there is support towards this particular clause, that we need to advertise those conditions upfront. Now comes an issue of thresholds. When we met in this house, we had said that on the 80-20 point system, the threshold goes up to 1 million, from 30,000 to 1 million. And it was this house's request that we need to relook at that, especially the ceiling. The ceiling, yes, we are still open. open to relooking at the ceiling. However, the comments that we're receiving is that we need to look at the minimum point, minimum threshold. It is the request that, especially the private sector, asking that we move the minimum threshold from 30,000 to 50,000. Now you can imagine, Mr. Chair, that if we were to move from 30 to 50,000 and all bids up to 50,000, you could do a telephonic call and do your procurement telephonic. We are a bit scared to move it from 30 to 50, as it might just open potential abuse of the system. At 50,000 telephonically, it's a bit risky that people might end up splitting bids, even if it's 100,000 bids, split it into two 50-50s and do it on a telephonic procurement. So that one, we strongly feel that the minimum threshold of 30,000 should remain. However, what the House had asked us around the increasing of the ceiling, it's still open for us to can relook at. Again, there was also around this 80-20 point system a request that we move from 80-20 to a 50-50 point system. We need to stipulate that the 80-20 and the 90-10 point system is captured in the Act. So we cannot tamper with that. It is within the Act, and the Act requires of us to use the 80-20 and the 90-10. The regulations that we're dealing with is to see to what extent can we maximize what we have in the Act to provide for the shortcomings that we see. The concern on regulation on clause 5 that was raised, and which is a very genuine concern, and it was until we were doing this summary that we realized that it is actually a very, very, very touchy issue. Where we're talking about the joint ventures, the scoring of joint ventures within this point system that we are proposing, that if in the joint venture one member of the joint venture is maybe on a lesser scoring level and the other one on a higher scoring level, it might just jeopardize the joint venture because it might decrease, if you average it out, it might decrease the points that they're scoring. So this needs careful consideration, and we're saying we definitely need to look at it because the gaps that we find within the levels of contribution sometimes get tempered with if you were to use them on a joint venture allocation of points. Another point which I find extremely important is on clause 6. I think in this one we may have to relook at this one very carefully, because here we're talking about the preference points for the sale and letting of assets. That's clause 6 and 7. The letting maybe might want to be separated from this, because letting, you just leave it to sale, but letting perhaps get out of it because you're letting a property. The other thing that has been raised, and it was raised telephonically to us as we were coming here, that we need to look at Regulation 6, because there is also a policy a decision that needs to come out of government as to what is it that's going to be done with things like land, because we don't want people to utilize these regulations and end up appropriating land through these regulations, and we want to separate that altogether from this, because appropriation of land is an issue on its own, and it should not be touched by this. So we want to make it extremely specific that land is not touched by these. And on regulation, on clause 8, it was about evaluation of bids on the basis of functionality. Now, there is a general feeling that functionality should also be included in goods. Now, in goods, we say no, functionality is only for services, because functionality is to see whether there is capability of performing a particular service. Whereas in goods, where you have to deliver a particular good to a specification that is given, you don't really need to bring in functionality. That you'll do it through your evaluation by specifications and standards that are laid down, and to see whether the people do conform to the standards that are given. So, in this particular one, we say it will certainly not affect the goods. It will only affect services. And further on, there are issues of, again, you know, the word should and the word must. To us, we'll leave that to the legal people to refine that, because we find it to be a difficult sentiment to deal with. And those semantics, we leave it to the legal people as the final refinement of this. Regulation 9 says, it talks about the award of contracts to bid scoring, not scoring the highest points. You'd remember, and this house raised it also, that we said if you were to award a bid to a bidder that's not scoring the points as required, the reasons for doing so needs to be stipulated and needs to be reported to the Auditor General and to the relevant treasuries. And the House raised, if you report it to the Treasurer or the Auditor General, what should they then do with that? Should they act on it or should they not act on it? It was our feeling that we need to engage the Auditor General that in instances where these are reported to them, the Auditor General may have to have some separate way of dealing with these things by scrutinizing those deals that have been given to those other than those that were supposed to get the deal. So where you are passed over when you have the highest points. Because the reasons also differ. We don't know what some reasons may be reasons of capability, some reasons may be reasons of not fraudulent certificates given to us, and all those kind of things that may come in. So the Auditor General may have to scrutinize that. And where we find that there is areas where fraudulent action has taken place, that those areas should be followed up and the necessary action be taken. Now, in case of the SOEs, again, we also say, although it will be followed up, we need to carefully indicate what the board's mandates would be in cases of fraudulent actions and in cases of corruption. What will their mandate be to look at that? Given that they've got a board that has got a mandate to govern these things. So we may want to explore that further to see to what extent should we do that. So the reasons for Passover must always be given and notified. Why is there a reason for that? Now, Regulation 10 talks to the cancellation and reinvitation of bids. Again, here we were talking around where a bid was supposed, if we had gone out on an 80-20 point system and the bids come out, the prices that we get are beyond the 80-20, are on move to the 90-10, that we may have to cancel and re-invite the bid, and the other way around as well. And here, the comments that came in were very negative towards this. we then looked at the comments. We found that some of the comments, there is merit to the comments as raised, because it might result in unintended consequences. If, for instance, we cancel the bid at the 80-20, where bids, where people have paid for their bids, it becomes a bit of a problem when people need to be reimbursed. It becomes also a problem where people now know what the prices are, that the process itself might just result in areas that we would not want to find ourselves. Now, and in other instances, we might also miss the opportunity of cost reduction, because now we shall have moved the bid from a certain threshold level to a higher threshold level. And then we had these general conditions, which is Regulation 11. I think this is the crux of the matter. Here we talk about a number of things on the general condition. One such issue is local manufacturing. And there are, of course, divergent views to this, that the regulations should talk to local manufacturing. And we get this from various sectors. Some sectors say it must drive the local manufacturing vigorously. Some say, no, we must have a balance. And you'd see if you read through these, what public sector, what organized labor and private sector say on this, it's two opposite views. And it is a feeling that some issues are of industrial policy nature. And you don't use procurement to determine industrial policy, but you need to have your industrial policy in place and use procurement to leverage in order to support the industrial policy. So there we need to start having industrial policies that would talk to issues of local manufacturing. I mentioned the other time when we were here that there is also a stipulation that the Department of Trade and Industries can pronounce on. For instance, they had pronounced on textiles that before you procure any textile commodities in the outside the country, you need to explore internally to the country and find permission from the Department of Treasury or of Trade and Industry that there is no such garment here, that you are importing the garment as your offering. So if you do not have that kind of a permission, the bid is not looked at. So the issue of local content became very, very, very contentious here. I must also mention that we're meeting again on Friday with NEDLAC. They would like to raise this issue with us. They would like to give us their views around this. We would engage with them on this and see to what extent can we look at this. There are also other issues within here which talks to the various accreditation agencies, where we talk about accredited verification agencies that needs to give the certificate of accreditation. Now, here the problem is, at this stage, we've got very few accredited verification agencies. And the second thing that we find ourselves grappling with is, how would we be in a position, if we want to verify the authenticity of the certificate as given, should there be challenges around that? So that to us remains a huge challenge. Because if you get the certificate, now how do we verify the certificate? If we find the certificate not to be correct, what do we do further beyond that? it's very gray to us on that. And unlike we with a tax clearance certificate, it's easy for us to verify the authenticity of a tax clearance certificate because there is a seamless system that we work on towards that. So, I think on this one, we were saying with colleagues that we need to still debate with our colleagues at Trade and Industries around the regulating of these certificates and how we find the authenticity. Some of the comments that came in here were comments of like numbering certificates to ensure that, you know, those procedural things that you would say if it's numbered one, then it means it's for this year, if it's numbered two, it's for the second year. But still, whether it's numbered or not, one should be in a position to verify the certificate. I'm saying this, members, because a number of things have come up since these things around verification. We've heard of a number of verification agencies that have come up, save for those that have been accredited by SANAS. And it's verification left, right, and center. And those verifications, some of them, it becomes so difficult to see what they are. And I may share with you that there was a particular concern that was raised with us, and the documentation was sent to us, where an organization doesn't in any way meet the verification level that was given by the verification agency, and they were given a very good grading. And looking at that, when confronted and under interrogation, the member of the company said, "No, I had to give a certain amount of money to get that kind of verification. So, depends on how much you pay to get the right verification." So, this remains an extreme challenge to us, and we want to close this gap before we pronounce on this regulation. Or on principles, which is clause 12, it talks again to exactly what we had on clause 5, which we said these are areas that we need to look at. It's this joint venture situation, because these regulations are to a great extent silent towards the joint venture situation. And we do know that a number of businesses are being tendered for on a joint venture basis. On regulation 13, we said the bidding organization needs to also certify that the information is given is true, it's not false, and it's not misrepresented in any way. There were a few, especially organized labor, saying, "No, this is an irrelevant regulation. We need not clause. It's not necessary for us to put it in." It is our feeling that this regulation is necessary, especially when we come to cases of litigation. If we were to go to litigation and we present documents in court, we should be in a position to say these are documents that were given to us and signed for as being true copies of the documents by the bidder. So we feel that this regulation must stay, this clause must stay in the regulation. And regulating 14, where we spoke about remedies, there is a view out there that says that we need to consider having an ombudsman that will handle appeals around issues of procurement. We note this. However, one needs to also indicate that there are a number of initiatives within government that deals with issues of ombuds, and we just say we need to look at this, not to duplicate what we already have in government. We also do realize that at some point in time earlier in the year, that the Minister of Finance also did pronounce that there is a compliance monitoring unit that he's looking at. And those are areas where we think these things could be directed to, rather than having to duplicate the current efforts that we have. On clause 15, members asked, members of parliament, of public asked, that we need to make the system a bit simpler, because they need to go to the tax offices, they need to get tax clearance certificates and make all sorts of arrangements. Can't we make it much easier, because we are government? Can't we just link into SARS and have this seamless checking of tax matters? Of course, we also do know that it's a tedious exercise to go and get all of these tax clearance papers. Now, a work group has since been established, since we got these comments, between the National Treasury and the South African Revenue Services, to see to what extent can we find a manner in which we can have a seamless approach that will deal with getting a tax clearance certificate. Now, the other comments came up on Regulation 17. And this regulation, there's a strong feeling that we need to go back to the principle of set aside. And the principle of set aside is that we need to set aside a certain procurement for a certain grouping of people. Now, that feeling, I understand the sentiments behind them. However, there is also a legal view that has gone through the Constitution and indicates that the principle of set aside is unconstitutional. And that is why the Constitution went on to say we'd rather utilize a preference system rather than having to set aside any procurement. However, the voice is getting stronger out there around the set aside. Now, it is our feeling that the issue of set aside needs to be tested again through the legal process. But at this point in time, these regulations, the mandate that we have on these regulations is to align the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act regulations to those of the broad-based black economic empowerment. So the issue of set-aside at this stage falls short of what we are mandated to look at. So we wouldn't want to change anything other than that we have been mandated to do. And a lot of justification, of course, is given by the various people that commented. They also wanted to increase the thresholds, as it was indicated here in the House, so that it caters for small businesses. And the others were, if we can't do that, let's break down this 90-10, bring it to 100%, and then give 50% to local, 30% to another grouping, and so on, and so and so. And again, you know, if you put that as a static thing, that this is how you're going to do it, businesses will be structured to do just that. But if you put it that you address a particular element of business through procurement, you'd structure your procurement to address that kind of element, rather than to have one static, one-size-fits-all position. So these are the kind of comments we got. And I would ask my colleague if he's got any other additional comments to just give it up. Thanks.
Sure, I think you said when we're in your hands.
You're happy. Okay. Thank you very much. I've noted some hands. I just forgot to mention at the beginning that this is a joint committee of finance and appropriation. You know, the tendency is that of wanting to appropriate everything for appropriation. It's a joint function, and the chairperson of finance was in another engagement in parliament. He is now around here. You're welcome, chairperson. And your seat is also waiting for you here. We will not allow you to lead from behind. You have to move here. Colleagues, that is the feedback. Chair, it's a pity that you did not hear everything, but everything that is I have said is written down. They were just speaking to their document. I have recognized Honorable Dr. Ravi, Honorable Swart, Honorable Van Rijn, Honorable Wienge, Madam Nkosaza, in that order. Honorable Dr. Ravi.
Chairman, there are comments. I think it's been a very interesting submission. But I'd like to sort of, I think in your submission, you mentioned that there's a potential to abuse the system. And apparently when it came to the verification agency, apparently there are, some of them use norms which is not acceptable, which was not known to the York department. And you also mentioned the fact there that there was one particular agency that said that they paid in the, or a certain tender paid X amount of money to an agency to get a high qualification verification. And have you pursued this particular? Have you pursued this particular institution that made them guilty of this particular thing? And what are you doing? What proactive steps have you taken to stop this abuse of the system? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much. Yes, thanks to the presenter. I'm very pleased to note, you know, that they've obviously consulted very widely on this whole issue. But I find it very difficult to comment at the moment because there are a number of issues here where the presenter say, you know, if you look at page 3, five, for instance, it says, this concern is noted, this is now the Treasury comment, and it needs further work, and there's a lot of these where Treasury feels that they've still got to give, you know, inputs. Now, we don't know what those inputs are going to be, so it's difficult to contact, you know, to comment on that. I'm just wondering whether we shouldn't wait until we have, you know, the final draft before we actually, you know, have a final look at the whole situation.
Thank you, Chair. So, in my process of trying to understand how do we perfect this notion of public participation on issues of parliament or maybe on issues that has to do with this regulation. I'm tempted to ask the method that has been followed, I mean, to collate these submissions, but also to check if this method accommodated those who are at the country level of this process, that is our entrepreneurs, who, of course, majority are emerging entrants to this process. To what extent were they accommodated in this process? And I'll keep on raising this question because I'm of the opinion that our parliamentary constituency offices are not used, I mean, or maybe they are not utilized, I mean, to enhance, they are not utilized properly to enhance processes of public participation. To what extent did this process accommodate parliamentary constituency office? Because these are the centers that have been created to make sure that we collate submissions, but also we are able to take the views of our people and present them to relevant structures in this institution. To what extent were PCOs utilized in this whole process? But lastly, to check maybe with members if, in their opinion, the method that they have utilized to collate these submissions really assist us to realize our constitutional obligation of ensuring that we encourage and promote public participation on matters of government. What is their take? Is this approach that we are currently employing, is it really assisting us to realize that constitutional obligation? Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade, Comrade Liana. Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think, Chair, I belong in the school of thought that says we need to have a pure, a fully-fledged draft, because if you are dealing now with a draft of a draft, then you don't know where to locate yourself and feature or maybe put whatever flesh on a skeleton. So it is a skeleton of a skeleton. It is not assisting us, because Chair, the presenter has actually touched on the issue of the mushrooming of the verification agencies, of which the bidders cannot actually be verified correctly if the authenticity or the legitimacy of the verification agencies is doubted. Maybe what sort of mechanism is the presenter now contemplating to employ in terms of ensuring that at least the verification agencies are authentic and legitimate? Thank you.
Thank you, coaches. I would like to follow the two honorable members, including Uswart. As far as the document that is image that is the draft of a draft, but also saying to the Treasury, thank you very much, because you need to start from somewhere to have then the final draft. So for the work done thus far, we appreciate that, but we'd like to have a final draft. Now, to add on that final draft, I really do not agree with the National Treasury when they say the definition of functionality excludes the goods. In other words, the National Treasury is saying, let this country receive whatever kind of clothes, whatever quality of goods that are coming into this country. You can't guarantee that the standard of the whatever accredited agencies that monitor the quality of goods are doing the right job, unless the law ensures or enforces that. So I will request that in that definition, which is I, we add of a service and goods, because this country needs quality to whatever goods that are manufactured internally or are coming outside. And two, I'm also a bit very worried about the National Treasury overlooking the set aside and referring us to the Constitution, when we remember very well that fortunately enough, the country is still led by the ANC, and the ANC for that matter in the presidency, they've opened a division for youth and women, which means there is a set aside by the leading party and the disabled people. Why then the document is not going to have the set aside of the previous regulation? I think that the regulation, it even had what you call the BWO, the Black Women Owned Enterprises, and which you don't see it in this. What about the disabled people? If the PIT document is there, don't they get the preference because of the act? So I've got a problem with that. So now that the Treasury, we say to the Treasury, go back and give us the final draft. Can they take into consideration of that? And then the last one, Co-Chair, is the, you know, it's about the lead and the sold public assets, which go through the public auction. I've got a problem with, I think this is, I think it's 0.7 clause 6. If any assets are let or sold by public auction, the award must be made to the highest bidder. Now, we've been to auctions, and you'll find that the government here is expecting something like 40 million. And then the highest bidder, because the bidders, they go there after the caucus. They say, you're going to bid, and the Honorable Speaker is going to bid this, and Honorable Susan, and what. We caucus first. Then you find that the highest bidder doesn't even meet what the government is expecting. Rather, the government can keep the building and do something about it. Now, why don't we just say, then at the end of that Sunday, we say, made to the highest bidder after the approval of the price by the stakeholder. Because the auction, you can play numbers with it. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
Two conditions, rather, if you want to shorten it. Thanks.
Asibonge Madlamini. Asize kumamtonga.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the meeting is agreeing on the process that we need to follow in interacting with the document. Really, it's not assisting us as members this document to make whatever contributions we feel they are relevant. But I want to take it further, Chairperson, to suggest that rather than wasting time of Treasury and Parliament raising issues, that Treasury needs to go back and relook at them, we postpone this meeting and request Treasury to go back and do their work and come back in the first week in our next term and deal with this issue and finalize it then.
I feel financial. I'm just attending. I'm tired. Mapolo.
Thank you. I really concur with Honorable Speaker, but I've got some questions of clarity that I would like to get from Section 11 or general conditions. The accredited verification agencies seem to be worrying a bit. Are they equivalent to the SABS? Or who trains the people that are in the verification agencies, and what are their qualifications? Because it looks like they can be manipulated at a certain point in time. The second question, Treasury has stated that there are things that Treasury knows. Maybe it's important that Treasury goes and works on those things that it has noted and then tell us of the outcome of the work that they've done. Like Madlamini, I also have a problem with the set aside being unconstitutional and preferential being preferred to set aside. Is this in contravention of the Equality Act, where there is fair discrimination allowed? Thank you.
Nyambo, Sabonga Mapola.
Before spoiling it, Chair, I was checking the process. If there is a proposer and a seconder and a seconder and a seconder, what do you call that? Because they've already proposed that this meeting, it must adjourn. We wanted to check whether there are other people who oppose that.
Now, Honorable Nyambos, now we hear what you're saying. You see, we're trying to be fair in that if you raise your hand, you must be heard. However, I would like to, as you were speaking, we're also trying to understand the proposal. National Treasury, when introducing this, one, we did indicate first that this is a second meeting from the first meeting that we had. We requested them to go and look at the issues that we had requested them to look at. However, I also, from the document that we're getting, it's not clear those proposals that we made they are not provided for here. Maybe they are provided for in the elsewhere. But I think what they are saying, I just want to understand the proposal. What they are saying is that since leaving here, this is the other consultation that they have done. But we had requested them that the initial date of the closing date was the 30th of September. And because they came to us late, we requested them to postpone. They have agreed to that. But in the process, they have had to collate a number of other inputs. So that now I understand them to be saying this process will contribute to finalizing this first draft, so that when we go to the final document, it will take into our account these inputs and the other inputs, so that now we don't take this process as a new process altogether. In fact, that's how I understand it, and that's why I'm saying let's give them this opportunity, but let's be very clear about the time frame. When is this document going to be finalized? That was, they had indicated to the House that once this process is closed and the final document comes back, it will still be, the House will still be given the opportunity to look at that final product. So that is why I thought that maybe somebody would take that into account. So I think then, let me start with Honorable Spieler, so that that's where the proposal came from. Honorable Slager, you noted, just for this clarity that I have given. Thank you.
Chair, I think we are together on this issue. We understand the processes. They've brought back the reports from the consultation processes. We are noting the consultation processes, and we're saying we will be able to interact with the final draft to see if all these recommendations that were made through the consultation processes are captured in that document. There's nothing much we can do about this report at the moment. So I think we are together, Chair. We've noted the report. We'll go back and wait. Await the meeting in January.
I also want to call it. Let me first give Honorable Sage and then a comment. Honorable Yene, you noted.
Thank you, Chair. Despite the fact that they haven't touched on all the questions that you gave them to answer, there are still those that are still pending. On that one, I think we will take a decision. But as far as this document that they are presenting now is concerned, if I listen to them all, they tried to clarify or tried to give us an understanding as to how did this whole process go on, and they have tried to cover what were the questions of concern. But what I heard from them is that on the issues like legal view that's set aside, on the issues like ombudsman, they have actually said, like on the issues of set aside, I mean, if a principle violates or it's not within the constitution, there's absolutely nothing that they can do. They can't act on something that they have, that it's not, it's constitutionally, the constitution does not give them the mandate to act on that. And if I understood them, they said on the issue of setting aside, it violates the constitution. So as a matter of fact, it's beyond their constitutional mandate. And even if we say they should come back, the issue of setting will be the same because there is no constitutional mandate that they can operate on that issue. And then on the issue of ombudsman, they said there are already some institutions within or systems within the present government that are actually acting or that the ombudsman will actually act like them, and they feel we cannot add the ombudsman because that will be duplication of the systems that are already in place. So I really don't know if we say they must come back, where now will they get all the mandate to deal with these things that are outside their constitutional mandate?
No, let's just address this matter first of whether the meeting is continuing or not. I've noticed you, Comrade Lien. So you want to comment on that?
I'm saying that's why I was making an addition to say, even if you say the meeting must adjourn, but you must not forget that on issues where they don't have a constitutional or a legal mandate, there's nothing they can do. They will still come as they are because there's nothing legally that mandates them to do that. So I was saying, as we decide whether we go on or not, we must think about those constitutional matters.
Comrade Liang.
I think here there is a clear enough and sufficient consensus that the meeting must adjourn on the basis of what the honourable members have actually put on the table, recognizing the fact that Treasury has done its work, has started, but they need to do more, and we agree on that. So what I wanted to do, Chair, is to maybe to raise this thing sharply, the issue that relates to public participation. I think on that one, when we get the final draft, maybe we will have an opportunity to interact with the communities. Then Treasury must not forget the notion that says this policy seeks to close the gap between the haves and have-nots. So it must say something about the previously marginalized communities, that is your youth, women, and people with disabilities, as it has been reflected by Honorable Dubaza. So we can't have a policy that says nothing about those sectors. They are very important, and they are a cornerstone of public participation and also the ability of our government to assist the previously marginalized.
You're supporting that. You say there's sufficient consensus, but you still continue to
to raise, you know, I thought that if the position that says we must, what you call it, there's no other position. Position that says we must adjourn. The position that says we've seen everything and therefore we must adjourn. But now you continue to raise issues. And that is precisely what I was saying, that we can dismiss this meeting to go, but we're depriving ourselves of an opportunity to raise those matters. Because we're saying the meeting must must adjourn. We don't raise raise the matters that we would like addressed when they come there to see that they have been addressed. We don't want to. I mean, that's what they want to call. That's what this a proposal means. And I'm not sure if that is what we want. We can do that. And we say to them, okay, thank you very much. You came, you had tea, you can go now. But we will come back and go back to those issues that we wanted addressed. Rather than saying to them, these are the issues that we want you to address. And I think that there's a couple of what you call issues as I was listening, including those the issues that you're raising, that Honorable Van Rooyen raised, public participation, your youth, everything that was raised in this House. But what will be the status of those proposals if we say to them, go now? That is the question that we are raising. So it is important that we address these matters and say to them, these are the matters that you have not raised. I mean, you have not raised. And so that they must respond to these matters. I agree with you with the issues that you have raised, but I just want to... I'm saying so we must not shoot ourselves in the foot as well. We can dismiss them. You're coming back. You want to have both...
Chair, you are confusing us. Because, Chair, this is very clear. We agreed that we are there. And we appreciate what the department has done. And the issues that we have said are the issues that the department must consider when they come back. The issues of participation, the issues of special program units, your youth, your women and people with disabilities, and these other issues. So we are empowering them. We are not just saying, no, go away. We don't need you anymore. So if the feeling is that there is not much that the department can say now, because we cannot interact with the document profusely now, but we are giving them some points to consider when they come back, Chair.
Chair, yes, I think there has been this proposal that we adjourn the meeting. I think it's going to help Treasury. They've listened to the concern that I've been raised, and it's also going to assist them that we're now giving them this document, which was the minutes of the previous meeting, where they can see the concerns we raised at that specific meeting, which they can then also incorporate into the final draft. But at the final draft stage, we will be in a position to actually have another say, because it's still a draft, it's not finalized. And I would just like to say that there's consensus that we adjourn the meeting, and I would like to second the proposal by the honourable member that we adjourn the meeting now.
I think, Chair, you should agree with the proposal from honourable members. And I think the people from Treasury, they've heard what honourable members want to be done in order to take the process forward. And as and when that document comes back, like they're saying, whatever document you're going to produce, it's not going to be a final document. Members will still have to interact with that particular document. So I don't think it constitutes a crisis. It is a useful interaction in the sense that they've been able to give them more clarity and direction that they should follow from here. Of course, the only thing that I would want to raise is that we should be mindful of the fact that the last meeting almost took the same shape, in the sense that we said, go and look into 1, 2, 3, 4. The presentation was incomplete. This is the second one. We can't continue to go on like this. It is very, very important that you take that into consideration. And if there are issues that you think you are not clear about as you do your work, nothing stops you from interacting with the office of the chairperson in writing so that we are able to assist you and help one another. This is not just a piece of legislation. This has got far-reaching implications in terms of what we seek to do, transforming the economy, helping black economic empowerment, and so on and so forth. So we can't delay this forever. We need to find a way in which you could kickstart the process and assist in moving forward. So I think, Chair, we should accept the proposal from honourable members. And take into consideration what the honourable clerk has said. And I think those issues, you'll be able to tease them out, you know, simplify, you know, your responses to quite a number of issues. I think we should do that, honourable members, without taking too much time.
Honourable Co-Chair, without raising your hand, thank you very much. I think that assists. I think that maybe the other thing that would help is to ensure that those matters that were raised, you know, like I indicated, I think this document, it does not reflect the issues that were raised that time. Just ensure that you refer to that discussion again. If you need help with respect to that discussion, again, feel free to contact the office of the chairperson, and because really these responses or processes of consultation do not reflect the discussion that we had together. Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned. The next meeting tomorrow is starting at 9:30.